You're listening to RevOps FM with Justin Norris.
Every marketing team wants attribution, but the weird thing is that it's often not that satisfying when they actually get it. I did a lot of multi-touch attribution projects as a consultant, and we got really good at implementing these tools technically, creating taxonomies, making sure the data was clean. But I found that when you actually show these reports to a C-level executive, it can be kind of underwhelming. They don't always pass the common sense test. People want to pick on details. And maybe that's because the idea of dividing up an opportunity like a pizza between different touch points isn't actually the way. Maybe that's not going to give us the answers we need. But where does that leave us? Because we still need to know what's working in marketing. And today's guest thinks there's a better way, and he's founded a company to make marketing mix modeling, or MMM, available to B2B marketers. And he's going to tell us all about it. So I'm super excited to welcome Mark Stuess, CEO of Proof Analytics, to the show. Thanks a lot for being here, Mark.
Hey, thank you so much.
And Mark, maybe one clarifying question. I've seen MMM spelled out as media mix modeling and marketing mix modeling. Which is the right way from your point of view?
Actually, it really represents the evolution of it over the last, say, 40 to 45 years. Back when Procter & Gamble first brought out what was then called econometric analysis, it was advertising. That's what it was really all about, hence the media mix modeling reference. As time moved on, channels proliferated, it became still very much within kind of B2C as a reference point. It became marketing mix modeling. Today, it is really go-to-market mix modeling because it includes not just marketing data and channels and investments and all that kind of stuff, but sales and customer success and product data, outside data, externalities, you know, the economy, your competitor actions. It really is today a much broader canvas, as it should be, right? That's the long and the short of why people say that MMM means media mix modeling or marketing mix modeling. And actually both of them are kind of a little bit passe today.
I want to give a shout out to the sponsor of today's episode, Knack. You know, I love marketing automation software, but let's be honest, the email and landing page builders are usually terrible. You can't make it nice without a developer, and marketers are going to find a way to break things or go off brand. You do not have time for that. So Knack is totally different. You set the guidelines and then give your users a building experience that's slick, modern, and beautiful. When they're done, everything goes to your map at the push of a button. And don't worry, it supports global teams, approval workflows, it's got your integrations. So head on over to revops.fm/knack, that's K-N-A-K, and get a special offer just for my listeners.
Maybe let's take a step back before that and talk about what was your professional experience leading up to founding Proof Analytics and what brought you to this direction?
So I was actually pretty much a classic marketer and communicator. I've worked across all of the different subsets of marketing at one time or another, and I've been a large company CMO. About a little less than 20 years ago, I was at HP, and we were all kind of in the middle of an existential crisis because the then CEO of HP, Mark Hurd, was a very operations-focused and a very customer-focused CEO, and he wanted to know why there wasn't more evidence of what marketing was actually delivering to the company. It was actually incredibly unpleasant. And about the only good thing that I can say about that whole experience that I had and that other peers of mine had was that it was highly motivating to change. I kind of got to a point where I said to myself, look, I either have to do something to fix this, or I just need to like go do something else. Cause it's not just about budget issues and all that kind of stuff. It's about credibility. What am I actually doing here? So in my particular case, for whatever reason, Hurd gave me a project to actually see what could be done to resolve this. And I didn't know jack at that time about analytics. I was not even a math enthusiast. And so I remember I went home that next Friday. I went through all the stuff in my garage and found a couple of old math textbooks from university and started to read them in ways that I never read them when I was in school, because I was actively seeking an answer. And all of a sudden I got to this section and it was all about multivariable regression, which is absolutely the cornerstone of causal analytics. It is the cornerstone of the scientific method of inquiry. It has so much credibility that, you know, it'd be hard to have more credibility than multivariable regression has. Not because it is perfect, but it is absolutely the best that we have. And today, it is actually the bedrock of causal AI. So I started working on this project for Verd, and he liked it a lot. And I guess my prize was he set up a mentoring session with the CFO of HP, Bob Lehman. The whole idea was, I want you guys to talk, you from your end and he from his end, and see if we can't get to a meeting of the minds between marketing and finance. This whole experience, it just changed me. And before he passed away, I had the opportunity to talk to Mark again and thank him for it, right? Because it was not fun at all, but he did me the hugest favor. So I started climbing the analytics ladder, right? The stairway to heaven, so to speak, right? By the time I was CMO at Honeywell Aerospace, pre any kind of automation for analytics, which meant we had to hire a ton of people in order to get the latency on the recalculation down, the scalability up, the cost be damned at this point, right? Because it was so important, and get the understandability of the outputs to the point where the business goes, and not only get it and believe it, but I can make a better decision today than I could make before as a result of this. And so then you kind of say, there's not very many companies that are willing to invest $7, 8, 9 million a year just in marketing analytics, particularly in B2B. You know, at that point, you start to realize that automation was going to be absolutely indispensable to solving the underlying root problem. So data science has a number of major problems in the business context, but they can kind of be summed up by the fact that it's too slow. So by the time they get you the insights, everything has moved on. You've already had to make the decision. The information is not comprehensible many times by normal people, and it's not scalable. So you end up with 3 or 4 mega models that get updated once, maybe twice a year. And so it's not agile, but big opportunity to appropriately automate and bring AI into that whole thing and really elevate all of this to a new level of accessibility and meaningfulness. And so that's why we built Proof.
And so I want to contrast MMM and the regression-based analytics that you're describing with what most B2B marketers are probably familiar with, which is multi-touch attribution. That's what pretty much everybody does today. What is the problem with this form of attribution from your point of view? Or is there a problem? Is it still okay? Can they be complementary?
As long as it's accurate data, there's absolutely nothing wrong with having a really good understanding of the customer journey, patterns in the customer journey, things like that, right? And indeed, a lot of our customers will include customer journey data in regression models. It's valuable. The problem is that it is not fit for purpose for what it's being sold to do. We can just start with the idea of bias. There's a lot of bias in that data. There's a lot of bias in the weightings of that data. So marketing teams set their own weightings in advance. It is antithetical to the mathematical principles to say that you can use MTA data to optimize anything, particularly spend.
I just want to unpack that to understand why.
MTA data is an effect. you're measuring an effect. You're not capturing the cause of that, and more specifically, the time lagged cause. So how are you going to optimize the money that you spent in the past at this point based on what you think you're seeing from effects in the present when you have no idea what the time lag is, right? So there is this assumption that the time lag is near zero, but that's just so not the case. Mm-hmm. B2B, the time lags can be extensive. What do I mean by extensive? 2-3 quarters. If we get into brand investments, it's double that. What exactly are you optimizing, and how do you know which part of your budget back in time you needed to optimize based on this effect in the present?
If we take an MTA scenario, just to make it like a little bit more clear, let's say we have an opportunity and we have 3 people in the buying committee that are part of that opportunity. And between those 3 people, there were, sake of round numbers, 30 different touch points that they had with different marketing initiatives. And those could be like they downloaded eBooks, they attended webinars, they clicked on ads. And so the traditional way is like, we're going to take those 30 touch points and we're going to take that opportunity. Let's say it's a $3 million opportunity. We're just going to divvy it up. And the way that we divvy it up could vary. We may pick some touch points as being more influential or not influential. And I totally agree with you there that it's kind of like arbitrary that they give you different models that you can choose from. And it's like, pick the one you want. Like, on what basis?
I don't think that marketers understand how transparently untrue the premise of MTA is to everyone else but them.
I want to get to the reality of the situation because this is the industry that we're in.
The reason why it went through adoption is that most marketers don't have enough knowledge of math to be able to recognize when something doesn't work. And number two, it was presented to them as a way of mining data that they already were generating in their stacks. So it was easy, in quotes, right, to do this. And I've been around it long enough and talked to enough marketers about it where everybody was shocked when they went into their first meeting with MTA data thinking that they were just going to be greeted as conquerors and victors. And to your earlier point at the top of the show, right, it was anything but that. It was very innovating for a lot of marketers. You could actually do it in Excel if you only have to do it on a very limited basis. But if B2B would just adopt B2C analytics, and also I would just add market research priorities, they would see a very rapid transformation of their credibility and their precision and everything else. And they can always modify it as needed, but the core principle is ready to go and has been for a very long time.
So if I recap your perspective, as I understand it, the touch points, the customer journey data, what the person did and when, that can be interesting, that can be valuable. The notion of then doling out credit to those touch points for revenue outcomes, not mathematically, statistically defensible.
Yeah, I would just add this. MTA at the end of the day is about pattern matching. It's about identifying large scale repeating patterns in the customer journey. And then the assumption is that if a bunch of people are doing the same thing over and over again, it must be causal. That is a complete fallacy. The same math is used, for example, and in fact, pattern matching too, is used to study climate change. Some are causal. Some are absolutely not causal. They happen all the time, but they don't mean anything. You can't just assume that because 1,000 people do it, okay, in one of your channels, one of your feedback loops, you know, it just keeps happening. That ipso facto means that it's causal.
I've always had this unease as well. A great example from earlier in my career, we had a self-serve SaaS app, what would be called product-led today. And everybody that signed up for that app got a welcome email. So from that point of view, you know, if you're looking at touch points, like the welcome email is very influential. It's very important, but everybody got it. So just because people got it and some people opened it doesn't mean you could necessarily infer that that was driving the outcome in a particular way. So everything we've been discussing is kind of like the current state. Let's contrast it now with MMM, and why does it not have these different shortcomings that we've described?
Number one, let's start with the shortcomings that it does have, right? It is very dependent, as is every analytic of any kind, very dependent on data quality, right? There's that old saying about GIGO, right? Garbage in, garbage out. Everyone is going to be victimized by GIGO equally. Beyond that, though, it has a lot of major advantages. It is a lean data mathematical process. So you do not have to have big data or even a lot of lean data in order to run these models accurately. And that is actually a huge factor. And one of the things that CDOs, chief digital officers or data officers, are grappling with right now on private LLMs is that their big data stocks, they don't have enough training data and they don't have enough operational data to run private LLMs. Everyone's been so understandably fascinated with what they can do with public LLMs that they haven't really thought it through in terms of the limitations on private stuff, right? Regression does not have this problem. If you say, oh, I don't have enough data to run regression analytics, you're not even remotely able to do any kind of AI. And I think that a lot of C-suites now are starting to say your creation and maintenance of a high quality data pool that's relevant to your function is a core competency. And if you tell us that you don't have the right data or you don't trust your data, that's on you. The other thing is you have to have some basic capability on the human side of the equation. So with Proof, for example, we have simplified the whole thing dramatically, automated it significantly in the right places. You don't need a full-blown data scientist to run it. You need a competent data analyst, and you really don't even need that person full-time. That's probably a half FTE, right?
Could we give like a Fisher-Price version definition of what MMM is? Like just so people can conceptualize it in their minds?
We live in a multivariable world where there's tons of potential causes, everything that you control and everything that you don't control. That's kind of a really super easy way to bucket it. And these all have interactions with each other across time and space that produce particular outcomes, causally speaking. This is a probabilistic calculation. So outside of certain physical laws like gravity, there is no deterministic outcome that's possible to determine, right? You'd have to know everything that there is to know about what contributes to a particular outcome to get to a deterministic answer. That's just not the way that operates, particularly when you're talking about human behavior. So this is the same math that's being used routinely to study climate change, to study epidemiology, to study economics. It captures time lag. So in the end, the report will tell you historically the stack rank of everything that you control and don't control that's in the model, its relative effect on this outcome. It will then forecast all that into the future so that you can then make different choices. And because of automation, we've sped that up to the point where you could run multivariable regression exactly like a GPS. Let's say that you're recalculating the model every week. New data comes in and is presented to the model automatically. It automatically recalculates and you see how the present now is comparing with the forecast that you had for the same period. And if there's a growing delta, you see, hey, okay, I need to make some changes. Stick with the GPS analogy. Need to reroute, or man, this is great. It's just totally tracking and it will tell you how much longer it's going to take for you to reach your objective, your goal, your destination. So there's a countdown. Regression is a huge part of the actual GPS that's on your phone that you use every day. And if you stop and think about it for a second, most business questions and indeed a lot of life questions are navigation questions. Where am I? Where do I want to go? What's the best way to get there? Do I have enough time and resources to achieve my destination? Am I going to run out of gas before I get there? Am I going to run out of time before I get there? If I have to be there at 9 o'clock for a meeting and the GPS says you're not getting there until 11, you're going to have to make some choices. That's part of it. It also captures all the headwinds and tailwinds that may be speeding you up or slowing you down. So in many ways, it gives you the answer to your questions.
Take a practical example along the lines of one of those questions. Let's say a company spends $100,000 a month on display ads as an act of faith, because those can be notoriously difficult to track. They're not always resulting in a click, but they could have impressions that could have an impact. So they're spending that $100K month over month, and the CFO challenges the CMO and says, why are we spending this $100K every month? What's it doing? And that's the question the CMO is trying to answer. How would MMM, does it compare that spend versus a particular outcome and try to show a causal relationship between them?
Yeah, multiple variables, right? So it's highly context oriented. All of these models are seek to capture as much of a known context as possible. What a lot of marketing teams figure out using exactly that scenario is they've been trying to justify that display ad budget in terms of demand gen, in terms of performance marketing. And that is just not the way that that typically plays at all. That is a brand reputation investment. You know, you kind of think about marketing expense as being essentially two big chunks, right? Brand and demand. Brand is easily 2 to 3 times more time lagged in its effect than demand is. It also sticks around a lot longer. The effects of brand investment doesn't deteriorate very quickly unless there is a major scandal of some sort, something like that, that all of a sudden breaches the trust wall. But absent that, right, it hangs around. The half-life is quite extended, whereas the half-life on demand investment is highly perishable, lasts maybe a couple months, and then it's gone. So the snows melt a lot faster with demand than brand. You have to then say to finance, we've never discussed time lag with you before specifically, but we all know that marketing takes time to have an effect. That simple statement is insufficient, because if we don't know the time lag, we will never know the ROI. So we now have the ability to say that this investment over here doesn't really drive demand, doesn't really pay off on this side. There isn't a quick return from a demand perspective. But from a brand perspective, this is how it is improving average deal size and average deal velocity. Those are the two big ones that we see again and again on brand investment. It is grease on the wheel of the deal, right? That's what brand reputation really is, right? It makes people buy more than they otherwise would and buy faster than they otherwise would. That is key in B2B because it's a higher cost, higher risk buy decision to begin with. And then today, if we layer in all the risk factors that people are worried about, it's even more important. I mean, if you really want to understand how trusted you are by your customer base, look at your average deal velocity. If you really want to understand how confident people are in your product's ability to generate massive amounts of value for them, look at their average deal size, particularly year one, certainly year two. A lot of people, just as a matter of principle today, are buying small in year one and testing it out. If you see a major uptick in year two and deal size, that is a major vote of confidence in you. If you don't, you need to really find out why that is. I guarantee you there's a reason.
Looking at our example, let's say the data set that you had the company had always been running those display ads. Do you need a period where those display ads are not there in order to demonstrate the impact of having them or not? Or is there a way, even though they've always been there, to somehow demonstrate the impact that they're having?
I think that the answer to that question is very much contextual. If we were talking about a correlation analysis, meaning this ad buy, right, against revenue, then yeah, you would definitely need some interruptions to be able to essentially create a control.
A control. That's the word I was looking for too. Yeah.
Right. If you're talking about multivariable though, where a lot of things are changing all the time around it, it's not necessary. That's actually one of the things that's really, really cool about MVR, multivariable regression, is that because you're bringing in so many different variables and because everything changes, particularly the stuff that you don't control, you're going to see exactly what you're talking about. You're going to see an implicit A/B test evolving across time.
We're talking about limitations, and one of the things we're talking about was being an aggregate versus tracking individual users.
Yeah. So one of the things that's really important to say about multivariable regression / go-to-market mixed modeling, et cetera, right, is that it is looking at all the causal relationships in aggregate. So it's not possible to say that all these things caused this one identified person to take the steps that they took. That's not what go-to-market mixed modeling is all about. It's about looking at a population-wide trend that's causal for a lot of people. One of the things that companies really appreciate, though, about this is that there's no PII in proof or in a regression model. So you don't have the security concerns that you would have in MTA or any of the other touch-based approaches, which are trying to tie broad investments, programmatic investments, to impact on a particular human being or a particular company. And to do that, you have to pierce the veil on identity, and that's a problem.
So it's looking at the big picture. So cookies, not an issue. GDPR, not an issue. It's really comparing bulk data sets and the relationships.
In fact, the only GDPR thing that we ever have to encounter is the login information for users of proof. So we keep that secured. But in terms of the data that's in the computations, it's a non-factor. It's just non-issue.
Is there a way to explain that multivariate regression to someone who maybe they've got high school math, first year university math? Because maybe that's a challenge. As you said, marketers, some of them are more quantitatively oriented, not all of them are, and they're going to need to trust this data. So they'll need to be able to make sense of how it's produced. You know, if it's just a kind of computer and it spits out an answer like, yep, do X or do Y.
They're already effectively thinking in this way because they're spreading out their investments across all kinds of different channels. So they're acknowledging the multivariable world in which they live. What they are not necessarily acknowledging is the fact that it's not a list of one-to-one correlations. My investment in display ads versus revenue, my investment in social versus revenue, my investment here versus revenue. That's not it. It's a tapestry that weaves back and forth with different time lags associated with it. Literally, the only way to capture that is with multivariable regression or econometrics or marketing mixed modeling, go-to-market mixed modeling, right? It's all the same.
Because the first thing that you mentioned is what we're conditioned to look for. Like we're conditioned to say like, I invested a dollar here and it produced $2, like these definitive statements. I think if I'm interpreting you correctly, you're saying reality is not that straightforward most of the time.
The final output can be that straightforward, okay? But the causality elements on it are going to vary with the whim. So a great example of this is Johnson Controls, right? So even before COVID really became a story, their analytics started to say, in terms of forecasting, right? For reasons we don't understand, all these different channel investments that we have historically made are showing that they're not going to be as effective in 6 months as they are now. A lot of these were physical events. This was not due to marketing data in these models. This was all about external data that was picking up these early signals. They decided, you know what, we are going to fly by instrument. We're not going to fly by what we can see. And so they started removing investments early from a lot of these things, and they were able to claw back quite a bit of money. And then all of a sudden, real life proved the analytics accurate. And so they were very happy about that. And then finance came later and said, hey, so sorry, we're going to have to cut you 30 or 40%. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was large. And they said, let us show you something. And so they modeled the effects of those kinds of cuts over the next 3 years. And it was so detrimental to the business that finance took a lot less and went elsewhere to get whatever they needed, right? So this is an example not only of how a marketing team used it to avoid waste, but also to avoid cuts that would be ultimately bad for the business.
And the sort of external data you just described, those are things that's not specific to any one business. It's common to the macro environment that many businesses are working in. Like if I come to you, do I need to bring that external data on my own, or do you have sort of global external data that you can match up with my business specific data and include in the model?
So we are not a data provider, but we can and do all the time help people locate data sets that are usually free. That kind of stuff is usually free, either from the government or major financial institutions or universities, things like that. So that's not a problem. You know, and it's great, usually just fantastic data. I mean, it's been totally scrubbed. So that's not a big deal at all. In fact, we live in the golden age of data availability. Even if it's not free, someone is measuring it purely speculatively in the belief that somebody is going to want to buy it. And so today with a credit card, you can subscribe to all kinds of data sources very cost effectively, particularly given how important it is to maximizing the investment. The other thing that I would just point out is ROI is really important, but you only know ROI looking backwards, right? ROI is a historical assessment. What is really important is forecasted ROI, and then the comparison between it and actuals. So again, this is very much like public companies issue guidance, and then they issue regular updates against that guidance. That is exactly what the C-suites of many companies are demanding today. It's like seeking an investment to start a new company. The first question the investor is going to ask is, what do you expect this to do in year one, two, three, four, five? And what's the basis for that projection? If you're just extrapolating from hope and best wishes and all that kind of stuff, that's not much of an argument. But if you're doing regression-based analysis, that starts to mean something.
And listening to the examples that you described, it does feel like a very enterprise-oriented solution. If I work at a company, 400 people, 50 million ARR, is this something that can work for us, or do I need to be of a certain size threshold for it to be useful?
No, actually, it totally scales. The reasons for investing in it are going to be different in a small, medium, or enterprise-type business, but it totally scales. And the cost is totally approachable even for mom and pop, right? So the reasons for doing it as a small and, let's say, the lower half of the medium-sized business are mainly because if you make a bad investment in whatever, it has an almost immediately negative effect on cash flow. It's too much risk. So that they are modeling to avoid that. We do have some small customers, and that's their main reason for doing it. If you are an enterprise and you're spending, I don't know, $200 million a year on marketing, right? And you spend it wrong, what the CFO is most concerned about is things like opportunity cost, right? That's the comparison that's going on in their mind all the time, particularly today, is what are all the different ways that I can spend this dollar, and what are the most effective, what's most likely to give me the biggest impact? That's the competition. That is the Game of Thrones, particularly right now in budget season. The budget season right now is sort of year round now, right? Because everything is so pressed. So if you are a marketing leader, you are in competition to show that the money spent with you is a better return than if they spent it in IT or HR or whatever, right? You also need to really understand this. You marketing, by definition, is a non-linear multiplier of areas of business performance that are linear, one of which is sales. So in simple language, your leverage, you are bringing huge amounts of leverage to sales performance that sales cannot create for itself. It's not a ding on sales. It's just the nature of the reality of the situation. What do I mean by linear and nonlinear? Okay. It means that if I were to go to my CRO and double revenue goal for 2024, the first conversation that they're going to want to have with me is about essentially doubling their sales force, right? Because the relationship between revenue coming in and the cost of that revenue in the form of sales team is established. It's known. It's a linear function. And that's because it's the collective performance of a lot of individual performances. Okay. So a bell curve, your sales team's performance is going to be on a bell curve. It's just fundamentally linear. The whole reason why modern marketing was created in 1890, whatever, was to bring nonlinear leverage to that whole equation, even in B2C. So what does that mean? It means that because of the way marketing is, if I were to have the same conversation with the CMO, hey, we're doubling the revenue goal, might have to increase marketing spend by 25%, maybe 20%. Because there's already a ton of leverage built into it. And if you want an easy understanding of ROI for marketing, it is the extent of that multiplier. So we'll talk about it this way. You are basically saying that marketing's mission is to help sales sell more product to more people. That's revenue. Faster, that's cash flow from revenue. And more profitably, that's margin impact, than sales could do by itself. That's the key phrase. The extent to which that is true is the ROI to the business. So what does that actually look like in real life? Well, in a lot of really, really great B2B marketing, go-to-market kinds of operations, the ratio is somewhere between 10 and 20x. So that means that if you take marketing away entirely, which I think would be something that not even the most draconian CFO would ever contemplate. But let's just say it is the ultimate A/B test. So we're going to completely shut down marketing. You're going to see a massive fall off. It may take a year, but you're going to see a massive fall off in sales productivity that is going to reveal the extent of the marketing multiplier. It's like literally guaranteeable because sales can't create the leverage for itself. It's just not the way it works.
If a company is getting started with this solution, what would the process be? Like, what data sources would we need to bring? How much time does it take to build the model? That sort of thing.
The very first step is, this is part of the onboarding for us, is that we sit down with the customer and we say, look, what are your top 20 questions that you most want to know the answer to? This is a mixed audience, usually, of marketers and business leaders. And it doesn't matter what your job is, nobody has any problem rattling off their list of questions. Those questions then generate what's called a model framework. You could easily analogize that to a recipe card. So this is going to be a punch list of data types that you're going to need to be able to supply to the model to compute the answer. And then it's going to outline the model itself, algorithmically speaking. When you actually make the dish from that recipe, that is the model. Usually the way this actually works is it's very fast. It's usually a matter of weeks, like less than a month, that kind of time frame, where the analyst and the business user, could be a marketer, could be a finance guy, could be whatever, are collaborating in the tool on a minimum viable model. And at some point, the business user says, that answers my question. We need to put this model in production. You hit the big red button, it goes into production. After that, it's pretty autonomous. I mean, there's kind of some DevOps type work. You know, you have to maintain the model and all that kind of stuff, right? But for the most part, it is doing its thing on an automated basis. And you're getting whatever cadence is right for your business, right? Daily, weekly, monthly, you're getting an update on demand.
The analyst that you just described, is that someone that you're supplying from your team, or is it kind of a bring your own process?
You know, we have a large partner ecosystem that we can recommend from. We also occasionally can do it ourselves on a managed service basis. That is actually increasingly popular as teams get thinned out and they know that they need this capability, but they don't have the bandwidth or the expertise to manage it internally. And so that's actually extremely popular these days and very cost effective. The key thing is that there's a lot of, you know, you could easily spend 20-25K up front in time, not in licenses, okay, but in time to get everything set up. But once you've done that, right, again, the models, unless you need more models, the models are doing their thing. You don't have ongoing major investment, you know, every month, got to redo the whole thing from the ground up. That's exactly the kind of thing that Proof was built to eliminate.
And if you add a new, so, if you add a new channel, do you have to update the model, or the model can be flexible enough to just say like, oh, you're doing LinkedIn advertising now. That's fine. We can just incorporate that as we go.
You could do it either way, right? I think the best practice is that you clone the model that you have, and then you add the new data streams to it so that you're maintaining the integrity of the original model comparison, and yet you are updating it that way, right? And then at some point, you're going to dispense with the oldest version of the model altogether. So it's not like you just see a massive proliferation of models across time, but you do need to do this in an orderly way so that everybody doesn't lose reference points.
You mentioned competitors, and I've seen competitors popping up in the market, even a multi-touch attribution vendor that's adding MMM to their mix. What's your outlook on how easily other vendors could recreate these capabilities? Do you feel that you have a fairly strong competitive moat around the offering you've built, or will other people be able to jump into this environment and offer similar things fairly easily?
So it's really important to say this. The competitive advantage that anybody has is not in the math. So if people propose that they have some kind of supercalifragilistic algorithm, you need to be very careful about that, because the odds also are that it's not transparent. It's a black box. And also, even if it is transparent, you probably don't have the ability to evaluate it. In our particular case, the IP that really matters is in how we automate it, how we scale it, how we make it consumable and approachable and understandable, and how we do it at a particular price point. And I think that this is the other thing that is highly relevant today, not just in this area, but across SaaS, is that prices are coming down. We're going to see a fundamental change in SaaS pricing. The days of, you know, every year having a pricing increase are over. It's just done. We are very well fixed, competitively speaking. We do have a really solid moat. So there are a lot of competitors today that have some great products, but these are products that were conceived of and written by and for data scientists. And a lot of them are gorgeous, by the way. I mean, like graphically, they're gorgeous. But if you expose them to a normal business user, a marketer, sales leader, whatever, they're going to stare at that screen and go, I have not a clue in the world what that means. Like, how do I make a better decision based on that? You've just now thrown a lot of friction into it. It's taking more time. You've got to spend a lot of time translating the data science outputs into something that is usable. And we don't do that. We built it with the end user in mind without violating any data science principles. That's our big advantage. I think one of the biggest things I can say about this, just to sum up, is that there's a reason why large B2C marketing teams, CPG, hotel and hospitality, retail, whatever, they control all four P's of marketing, and they have at worst a de facto authority over and responsibility over the P&L of their product, with their marketing. There's a reason for that. They are using econometrics / go-to-market mix modeling / MMM. They're using that to optimize and to understand causality and to optimize based on that causality. And they're also investing a ton of money in market research, which a lot of that ends up in the models, right? So if B2B marketers want to have the same attributes as their B2C brothers and sisters, they're going to have to do what B2C does. This is one of those situations where it's like gravity. You can disagree all you want to with gravity, and if you throw yourself off a building, it's not going to end well. The same thing is true here. This is a mathematical principle at work. It's mathematical law of gravity with quotation marks around it. And so everything that I've said today, and I really try really super hard to do this, is not my opinion. I'm just representing a level of fact that people can either accept or reject, but it doesn't change the truth of it.
We'll include a link to your website so people can check it out, learn more, look at your resources. I'm excited to see where this goes. Mark, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. I want to invite you over to the RevOps FM Substack community, where you can sign up to get rough transcripts, show notes, longer form articles, and other bonus content. Just head over to revops.fm/subscribe to get free access. I'd also love to know what you thought of the episode and to hear suggestions for topics you want to learn about. Feel free to leave a comment on Substack or send me an email at justin@revops.fm. Thanks for listening.